Talk given Saturday, 20th May 1972. All the world salutes death and pays homage to the dead and the memory of the dead in various forms. There are all sorts of ceremonies established in the great religious followings of the world for the sake of the dead, the souls of the dead, as well as for the sake of those who are alive. But there is one form of death which only the few do salute and can salute and welcome it with profound understanding and peace in their hearts. And that is the death of the entity self, which everyone treasures and grasps and clings to for all his worth. Remember the Buddha's words after the enlightenment, when he was experiencing the bliss of freedom after the enlightenment under the Muchalinda tree. Muchalinda means the serpent king, that's its literal meaning. As he is sitting there, a great storm arises. Then the serpent king winds his coils round and round, makes a great hood to shelter the Buddha. And then the text goes on to say that he understood the matter. And there's a short verse afterwards of about 7 or 8 lines, which ends up with, "He who doth crush the great I am conceit is indeed the happy one, the blissful one." The word conceit there is used in the sense of a fanciful notion. And I think that in this context he uses the term I am in the sense of the popular belief in the mannequin soul, the described limited Atma of the size of a thumb seated in the heart as it is, I'm sure, symbolically spoken of in the Upanishads, but literally believed in by the multitude. And not merely by the multitude. Great minds, great souls have held on to this belief of the permanent entity self, a finite, limited, existent, which nevertheless is immortal. And these people have never seen the contradiction involved in that belief. It is extremely important for us really to penetrate into this. We ourselves here may not hold that belief. That is to say, we think, we imagine that we don't hold the belief. But if we are capable of looking wholly and completely into ourselves, that is to say, into all our psychical processes and the way we are conscious of existence, we will find that we are still bound fast by a clinging to the entity self, the separate entity self. If this illusion of an immortal entity self were absent altogether, then we would be totally free of all self-orientation. We would be wholly unobstructive to the one total reality, to the energy of transcendence itself, and it would flow through us perfectly freely. Which means that each of us would no longer be a producer of the ill state, the imperfect state, the far from the infinite, that which spoils the transcendent. Our whole psychical life, our whole inner life then would be entirely of an entirely different quality. Let us have a little look into this, into the arising of this clinging to an immortal entity self. After one is born, when one is a very little child, the body, the living organism, is the me. This is me. Any little child, any healthy, sane child, quite naturally, quite rightly, will say, this is me, identified with the body. It gradually learns to refer to itself as I and to everyone else as you, or he or she or whatever the pronoun may be. The little child is extremely conscious of the I itself as compared with others. Others around are instruments of its own enjoyment and happiness. And only in so far as others give me satisfaction and pleasure, do I like them, love them, and so forth. But let them give me displeasure, and immediately out comes, I hate you. Little child, quite spontaneously, one moment is full of love and affection for the other one, the next moment it can shout, I hate you, because it has been displeased. And a few moments later it can again make it up and say, I love you. But the important thing is this, the intensity of awareness, of consciousness, is all interned upon itself. This is what we must bear in mind very carefully. because this remains with us in some degree or other to the end of our days, unless and until there is complete enlightenment, complete purification, a total liberation from the illusion of an immortal entity self. Now, as I grow older, what happens? I start asking questions of my parents, usually, or maybe somebody else. Where did I come from? Where was I before I was born? That is the more significant question, because the wording implies the unconscious acceptance of personal, finite being before birth. Where was I before I was born? And coupled with the who made me, this mysterious I before I was born, the answer usually is God or some omnipotent or some transcendent something about which we know nothing and which we must worship. That means hold in supreme worth. This is the point. And then comes the other question. When I grow up and experience the reality of death, and especially the death of some human being, whom the family knows, whom I know, and so forth. And where has he gone to? What's happened to him now? And I might be told, oh, he's gone to the stars now. Or I might be told, he's gone to heaven now. And where's heaven and what is heaven? Oh, it's the place where God is, God who made you. What will happen to me? Will I go there too? This I crops up again. The assumption, this is the point, this unconscious assumption, that this I is going to be everlasting. If you're good, you will. And if you're bad, well. Now, don't talk about that. You see, you just be good and you'll be all right. Now, run along and play. So I run along and play. But inside my psyche, there is the seed of anxiety, of fear, of conflict, of wondering, is all well, really well? If I'm very extrovert and extremely physical, that may wear off after a time. But in the deeps of the unconscious, it is there always. And it is accepted. This is an inescapable psychical karma which belongs to everybody. Karma in the sense of a force in the psyche. And every force is a living agency which produces results. Then as I grow older and the intellect begins to get very active and so forth, arguments come up. And the whole idea of this immortal, finite, limited entity self becomes strengthened. Out of fear, out of pain, out of reaction against existence as it is, I may consciously and deliberately dismiss the idea of an entity self and say it's all nonsense. But inside the inner unseen depths, that idea is a reality. That is to say, it's a real force operating there all the time. And I will either be rewarded for good or I'll be punished for evil done. Now you see, what we have to penetrate into is this. Reality is one and total, whatever it is. I, a human individual, constituted as I am, with sense organs, which have only a limited range of sensitivity, between certain rates of vibration, if we may so put it scientifically, let in only a tiny fraction of the total stimuli and impressions that flow into me from what I call the external world. Only a fraction. But even that little fraction which seeps in through sight and hearing is far too much to be presented to consciousness. This is a scientifically known fact now. Far too much. And the brain and the nervous system have been so marvelously built by nature that they perform the task of eliminating a good deal of these impressions, a large proportion, as so much irrelevant buzz. The remainder is processed first and then presented to consciousness for examination. So, our actual conscious awareness of our existence in the becoming process is a very limited conscious awareness. We must bear this in mind very carefully. And even when there is enlightenment, there is of necessity a limited awareness, or else the organism would perish under the impact of all the impressions that are possible. The organism won't stand it. But in terms of the enlightened state, where that separating wall between what we commonly call the conscious and the unconscious no longer exists, but the mind is one great purified whole, functioning freely. Consciousness in its wholeness is totally aware, but it never seeps through into the discriminative activity of our minds. Our vijnana always remains vijnana. Otherwise the organism would perish. It's to safeguard the organism. So here and now, as we are, with our senses in action, we can never know all about everything. We must bear that in mind. In this state of limitation, the unconscious part of us, as long as we are unenlightened now, clings to this immortal entity self. It is because of that clinging that inevitably we are self-oriented. We cannot deliberately say, I will cast aside selfness, self-orientation. Right out of the depths of the mind, this immortal entity self has to find, experience its dissolution. It is this concept which we exalt by the name of the spark of God, or the world soul, or the one and only Atma, or anything inside me. It is this which is the parent of the devil in me. That which I consciously call God is actually the obstructor of the ultimate truth, the reality in itself. It is that which fills the mind as it functions here and now with all its clutter. And this is where right mindfulness has to come in. Our ordinary mindfulness is all self-oriented. I am being mindful because the enlightened one declared that this is the royal road to nirvana. And since I am still only the overgrown child, wanting everything for myself and what will give me pleasure and success and happiness, therefore I practice mindfulness in order to realize nirvana, the perfect happiness. And it is this petty little deluded mind which predetermines the whole shape of that nirvana and fulfillment and perfection and so forth. It knows all about it. It is a funny little thing. But it knows neither its funniness nor its littleness until there is the awakening. But if there is right mindfulness, then the dissolution of this supreme illusion, the fanciful notion, as the Buddha called it, of the I am, in this particular sense, dissolves away. Consider for a moment. Out of the context, I have to use the word context in order to be able to talk about it at all, in the context of the infinite or the transcendent, how can there be an immortal entity? A separate self. If we talk in terms of the purest essence of mind in you, then again, I would say we are talking nonsensically. Because mind, as mind, is the all, not as a collection of particulars, but as that which is not finite, not limited, not particular, which is totality, wholeness, free of measurability, immeasurable. Therefore, space, time, causation, and all these things are completely out. In other words, it is the unthinkable, unimaginable. How can there be a bit of it which can be appropriated by or given unto anybody? It has to be something limited which can be given unto anybody or appropriated by anybody. So you see, this entity self, which is an immortal entity self, which we arrogate to ourselves, is an illusion. But it is an illusion very hard to pierce through. Very hard indeed. Because this is held in our subconscious with great tenacity. The ego feeling, the ego sense, is an overpoweringly strong sense in us, starting with our bodily existence. Now I'll put it another way. We are conscious in the way in which we are conscious, because we are constituted thus and have evolved in the way we have evolved from our primordial ancestor. So our whole mental functioning and our awareness of things is of the nature that it actually is. We are aware of the one total reality in a manner which makes us separate out finite particulars from a postulated infinite whole. In actuality, there is only the one and only is. Supposing I were the Absolute, or you were the Absolute. Supposing for a moment. Just try and imagine. If you were the Absolute, the totality, the all-inclusive, would there be unrelated, separate particulars for you? There can't be. You would be whole conscious, total conscious. But this phenomenon of consciousness, which is a, for convenience we'll call it so, only for convenience remember, which is a mental phenomenon, this phenomenon of consciousness in us is still of a separative character. It is of a separative character because we are so constituted that it is impossible to withstand the impact of totality upon us. Is this perhaps one of the meanings of the statement in the books of Moses, in the Torah, no man can see God and live? We can understand that statement in several ways, but one of the ways might be this, that no man can become totally conscious and survive the impact, physically that is. The kind of awareness or consciousness that we have, therefore, is determined by our very constitution. First, we have to recognize that. That because of our sense perceptions, because of the particular type of brain activity which goes on in us, and all this has been brought into being by nature in order that we may exist at all on the globe, because of that, we are isolatively self-conscious, and we are separatively object-conscious. One object is separate from the other object. We are unconscious of the relationships between what we commonly say are quite different objects. Here is a piano, one object. There is a book, another object. And to us, they are completely different things. A book and a piano are quite different things. Well, obviously, of course, they are quite different things. And at the same time, there is an underlying, total and complete relationship of which I am normally unconscious. This sense consciousness and this identification of all consciousness with the objects of sense has been the great break upon our inner flowering out. That is why in the Upanishads, for instance, one is warned again and again that the great illusion is to identify the Atma with the body, or to identify the Atma with any and every object. And for the enlightened ones, you will also find the other statement that the Atma or Brahman is the totality, the body, the objects, everything. See why this was a secret wisdom. What's the good of saying such things to the ordinary man of the world? If he has that kind of brain and he exercises his intellect, he will have plenty of intellectual pleasure. And that's as far as it will go. It won't change him from being an ego-centered, self-concerned individual, and therefore a producer of evil in life. It won't change him from being that. Whereas religion, and in the sense of the living of the truly religious life, is totally concerned with the complete transformation of this in terms of its awareness, its consciousness primarily. You can't start at the consciousness end because consciousness is characterless. The way you are aware of things, its manifestations are the states of mind, our feelings, our ideas, our speech, our action, and the way in which we cling to thought, feeling, speech, idea, action, and so forth. Or how we do not cling to it. Or the skill and the perfection with which we maintain a right relationship with it in terms of being wholly attentive to it, wholly utilizing it, and letting it flow past. Because renunciation, relinquishment, the power of relinquishment is complete and perfect in us. then there is nothing left undone. There is nothing done which is evil. There is nothing of such a nature that it is, to use Theravada language, a substrate for rebirth. A force, in other words, in the hidden depths of the subconscious or unconscious, whichever word you like, mind, which will crop up, given the necessary conditions or circumstances in time and space, demanding expression and demanding payments, so to say. So now, one of our fundamental tasks is to see through this postulated immortal entity self. The entity self, as the mere organism, the psychophysical organism, is perfectly legitimate. It is there. We know that it is a limited entity self. And that, as an entity, can legitimately be called an entity. But no entity conception can be associated with the idea of immortality or non-finitude or total identity with the Absolute. When the Upanishadic sage said, "Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman," there was no entity self which was one with Brahman. Because the enlightened one, the liberated one, is the empty one, the transparent one, the all-lighted one. And whilst in scientific terms, the physical phenomena of light, part of them can be explained in terms of a corpuscular theory, and the other part in terms of a wave theory. One is particular, separate particles, the other is just this universal field, which has no particularity about it. Although in scientific terms, where physical light is concerned, we can talk like that. Where our spiritual inner life is concerned, where the realm of pure mind is concerned, there is only totality, whatever that totality is. And it is something which in itself I here can never know. Therefore, I can't start at that end. In the process of the living, the daily living of the religious life, I can only start at this end. The end where both my feet are in the mud. Now, the living of the religious life is such that I do not have to take my feet out of the mud. But if I truly observe my feet and my steps, and truly observe the mud, they all become transformed into the eternal light. Why? How? Because the separation, the denial of reality and truth is right here itself throughout this living organism. And insofar as this is seen, actually seen by the mind, by the inner light, by inner perception, as it is, so long as it is seen as the transcendent real, then it becomes transformed. This is the meaning of perfect mindfulness, samasati. It's not merely sati. It's not mere observation. By an isolated seeing subject, looking at an isolated, a separate object. This awareness in which there is this complete communion, this state of transcendent unity, which is the supreme karuna, compassion, the supreme wisdom, prajna, is a reality which, coming through into intellectual awareness, gets analyzed and split up. But if I am so fully awake and sensitive to what is happening, if I am really sensitive and awake to what is happening, I will know that this is what the intellect is doing, giving it verbal form up to a point, but that awareness in itself is utterly pure and transcendent. That is the state which is the natural state. For you, for me. And the natural state in its perfection is the supreme meaning of the physical state. The word physical comes from physis, nature, that which is the natural, that which is its own essential self. It's reality. Self in the sense of reality, not just a separate entity. See, I use words like empty and transparent. But the emptiness is the plenitude. There is indescribable richness in the void, in the emptiness. This void, which is the womb of the universe, is filled with living creation. To you and to me, because of the functioning of our senses, and later on because the senses and their functioning have been purified and the illusions are gone, we can see this void as a plenitude composed of a multitudinous variety. Each particular composing that variety being unique and marvelous, and the embodied transcendence itself. When one sees that, one is so awake that one has become incapable of dukkha, of evil, of ill. And when one has seen that, one has also arrived at complete freedom from clinging to the illusion of an immortal, separate entity. So the Buddha's words, the translation into English, that he who has crushed the I am conceit. I would like to translate what, I don't know the original Pali, I haven't got the Pali text with me for the Mahavagga. I would like to put it this way. He who has penetrated into and fully understood the I am conceit, he truly is in the blissful state. But remember, not to interpret the word bliss either according to the Oxford or Webster's dictionary or according to the dictionary inside one's own brain. Because all those definitions of bliss are hopelessly inadequate. Still worse, they are misleading. They are illusion producers. Because you will find that those definitions are such only because they spring from and are wholly related to a separate self-center. Therefore, be utterly free of that. And the reality will be there. In the beginning, transcendence. Through the proceeding of the becoming process, only transcendence. And at the end of the becoming process, when all this which is an appearance, a standing out of, to exist means to stand out of, ex-sistere. At the end of that becoming process, that which seemed to stand out of, no longer stands out of, but is itself the transcendent reality.